is our staff philosopher and a theologian. And this is, I think, his fifth or sixth book that he's written. But having read this book, it is, in my opinion, it's basically a weight of evidence argument for the God of the Bible. And of all the philosophers I've read in this subject, I think Ken's done the best job. And there's a couple of chapters, about two-thirds of the way through, where he kind of gives a summary of the weight of evidence argument. So it's worth buying just to get those two pages. And people have been asking me, you know, where's the best place to buy Reasons to Believe books and DVDs? It's actually right here. Yeah. Nobody gets them cheaper than we do, and that's why we don't bargain. Somebody there was trying to bargain. It's not going to happen. This already is the lowest price you can get anywhere on the planet, so that's the way it's going to be. So, but this gentleman with his birthday gift kind of reminds me of what I told you a few weeks ago about a survey they did on Father's Day and Mother's Day, how Mother's Day gets a church attendance that competes with Christmas. Believe it or not, it's the second or third best attendance Sunday. But Father's Day is at the bottom. They actually surveyed 1,000 pastors as to what kind of message they give on Mother's Day contrast with Father's Day, and it explains the statistics. Mother's Day sermons, how great and wonderful the mothers are. Father's Day sermons, how much the dads really need to shape up. No wonder you get that flip-flop on attendance. So,
but that's in accordance with the Scripture.
Well,
Christ commanded to love his wife. Woman's never commanded to love her husband.
That's true. But there's balancing exhortations on both sides. There's also balancing commendations on both sides. So when I read that article, it told me that you know, pastors need to start balancing their sermons. Because, you know, the Word of God is what is called a two-edged sword. There's the places where God is commending us. There's also the places where he's calling us to grow in the Christian character. And every sermon should have those elements. So hope you all did get to see the transit of Venus. But if you missed it, there's another one coming in 2117. So I would encourage you to live healthy lifestyles, because otherwise you're probably not going to be around to see it. So, and I shared that with our staff. They're all excited to see it. In fact, they're getting their pictures taken with the transit of Venus. But when Fuzz Ronda drove by, he says, "Hey, I'm busy. I'll catch the next one." So. Well, you'll see it. Well, it was a photo up there a little while ago. So they call it a transit because it's Venus coming between us and the sun. And of all the solar system repeatable events, this is the rarest of the lot. I mean, we get a lot of transits of Mercury for obvious reasons. Mercury is closer to the sun than Venus is. But the thing about a transit of Mercury is just a speck on the sun. And when you see a transit of Venus, it's a nice big disk. And that's because Venus is so close to us that it shows up as a really sharp, large disk across the sun. Yes.
Wasn't there some important science discovery that came from the first observation of this, or one of the observations?
Well, when telescopes were first invented, they were now able to actually see a transit of Venus cross the sun, and they could actually time the transit of Venus across the sun. And 200 years ago, 300 years ago, that was the most accurate way we could measure something called the astronomical unit. The astronomical unit is the distance of the Earth to the sun. And so by actually looking at the speed with which Venus crosses the angular diameter of the sun, they were able to determine with considerable precision the distance between the Earth and the sun. And why is that important? That's the basis, until very recently, of determining direct distances to stars. Remember your high school geometry? I'm sure you all remember this theorem, that if you know the length of the base of a triangle and the angles at each end of the base, that tells you the distance to the vertex. That's usually the first theorem they teach you in high school geometry. Well, that's the theorem that astronomers use to measure the distances to stars. It's also the technique that surveyors use to measure the heights of mountains or to survey streets or measure the heights of buildings, the widths of buildings. They use that same technique. And so that was the whole basis for determining the distance scale of the universe, because they would use that method to measure the distances to stars, nearby stars. It turns out that that technique, until very recently, only gave you distances to stars out to about 300 or 400 light years. But within those 300 or 400 light years, astronomers found things they called standard candles. First ones they found were Cepheid variable stars, where the period of variation is proportional to the brightness of the star. And because they're able to measure trigonometric parallax, that's a high school geometry theorem distance, to a Cepheid variable star, that means whenever they saw more distant Cepheid variable stars, that would give them the distances to those more distant objects. And fortunately, Cepheid variable stars are extremely bright stars. So we can actually see those kinds of stars out to about 60 million light years. So thanks to that high school geometry, we're able to measure distances out to 60 million light years. Well, the very latest is we're now using what's called very long baseline array astronomy to measure distances accurately out to 162 million light years. And we're not talking using standard candles. Those are basically the same geometry theorems. We can now extend it out to 162 million light years for two reasons. Number one, we're no longer locked into the baseline of the Earth's orbit about the Sun. We have found maser sources. These are very bright point sources that orbit about the supermassive black holes and galaxies. And so we can use the orbit of a maser about that black hole at the center of a galaxy. And, of course, that's a much bigger baseline than Earth's orbit. And then with very long baseline array astronomy, you're able to link. Well, the most powerful instrument is where they link 10 telescopes together that stretch from Hawaii all the way to the Virgin Islands. So it gives them a baseline of over 5,000 miles, which means you get the resolving power, equivalent resolving power of a telescope that's more than 5,000 miles in diameter. And so that thing can measure angles 100 times more precisely than the Hubble Space Telescope. And it was that technique that allowed us to push out measurements by those plane geometry theorems all the way out to 163 million light years. And the potential is we could push it even more distantly. It all depends on discovering what we call these water masers. In fact, that ties into what I'm going to be talking about in a minute here. Yes, go ahead.
Reading about this, this was the reason for Captain Cook's voyage, was to go out and observe the transit of Venus, which they figured would be way around the globe, so they needed to sail to it.
Right, right. Yeah, so, I mean, the British astronomers made that top priority for over 100 years. 150 years was to get the best measurements of the transit of Venus they possibly could. And, yeah, the British Observatory would actually send parties all over the world, because you go to different places of the world, you actually get a different line of crossing of Venus. I mean, where we were looking at it, it kind of cut across like this. That's what we saw at our office. But you go to different parts of the world, you get a different path cutting across the sun, which means you get multiple opportunities to measure accurately the astronomical unit. By the way, today we no longer need transits of Venus because we got radar. We basically bounce radar signals off of Venus and then time how quickly the signal returns to the Earth. And that's much more precise than timing the transit of Venus across the Sun. So that's how we measure the astronomical unit today. Yes, in the back.
That gives you lots of different points in our orbit as well, since our orbit is not quite circular.
Right, that's why you want to measure several transits of Venus rather than just one, because then you get to take out the, you can actually determine the orbit of the Earth more precisely. So that's an advantage. The problem is you've got to wait more than 100 years for the next transit. You basically get two transits of Venus 8 years apart, every 112 years, I think it is, or 128 years. So there was one in 2004. So my father was trying to claim he saw the 2004 one, but we all know better. He didn't see either one of them. So he really is going to have to wait till 2117. In the back, yeah, Mara.
I saw a video of it, and it kind of was going like this. Is that normal?
It is normal, just because of what's happening in our atmosphere. So you will get some distortion. So
it wasn't moving that way. It's just the way it looks.
Well, for example, here in California, we were catching a transit at sunset. And at sunset, there's a lot of atmosphere that's between you and Venus. And our atmosphere isn't exactly the best atmosphere to look through anyway, so. Pardon me? A lot better than Venus's atmosphere, that's for sure. So. Well, that's one of the wonderful things about our planet Earth is that our planet was born with an atmosphere more than 100 times thicker than our present atmosphere. It was literally 3 times thicker than Venus's atmosphere. But you can go on our website. I wrote 5 articles for today's New Reason to Believe, how it is such a big planet like Earth wound up being trimmed down to having only 0.2% of its original water and only less than 0.1% of its original atmosphere. So we've been blessed by having a very thin atmosphere and a very thin layer of water, all of which is critical if you want to have advanced life. Okay, let me see if I can get this up here. Now that we're done with Venus. Yeah, and it will be live streaming, by the way, and how we plan to run those skeptics forums is that we will be taking questions from the live audience, but we'll be intermittently taking questions that are streamed in over the web. So we'll see how that goes. Last time we tested it Monday night to make sure it works. This time we're going to be doing it Monday morning. Sunday morning as well as Monday evening. Okay. Let me begin with this discovery. It's actually relevant to our discussion on the origin of life that we had many months ago. And this was published in the Astrophysical Journal. And it's a search for this molecule, hydroxylamine, NH2OH, relatively simple molecule. Simple in the sense that we've already discovered molecules that are much more complex than this molecule. And so a group of astronomers looked at 6 giant molecular clouds in our Milky Way galaxy. And these are the 6 molecular clouds that have produced 123, the discoveries of 123 different carbonaceous molecules. All the way up to probably the most complex one they found is a glycoaldehyde, a 3-carbon sugar. So, they decided to search for this particular molecule. Why? Because it's a pathway for making amino acids. Hydroxylamine reacts very well with acetic acid, and you'll get glycine and alanine, 2 of the simpler amino acids. And so there's a lot of thinking that, for one thing, we know amino acids can't form on the primordial Earth. And so this is really what's driving astrobiology, since we can prove that amino acids can form in the Earth, and amino acids are crucial for the constructing of proteins. For the origin of life to have any kind of possible naturalistic explanation, these amino acids must come from outer space. And indeed, we've found a few amino acids in meteorites. The Murchison meteorite that hit Australia a few decades back, for example, has 6 of the bioactive amino acids. Interestingly, 14 of them are missing. There are 20 amino acids that make up biological proteins, and they found 6 in the Murchison meteorite. And by the way, as they looked at other meteorites, it still stands at 6. And so 14 are missing. But the conundrum is when we look elsewhere in the galaxy, we do not see amino acids, we don't see the nucleotides that are the building blocks of DNA, nor do we see 5 or 6 carbon sugars. Now, the easiest thing to be constructed in these giant molecular clouds would be the amino acids. And the easiest way is if you got this molecule reacting with acetic acid. That's the most straightforward way of making amino acids. And so this was a search to try to find it, that they know that if it reacts with this molecule, which isn't all that simple of a molecule, as you can see, it's got two carbon atoms and four hydrogen atoms. But they searched in these six giant molecular clouds, and the shocker was all they got was upper limits. They couldn't find it at all. Moreover, what really surprised them is that the upper limits they established, because these were very powerful instruments, they focused on these six molecular clouds, and the upper limits they established are a factor of a million times lower than what models predicted they should expect to see in these giant molecular clouds. And so this may be, well, it's an indication about why we haven't found glycine. Glycine is the simplest of the amino acids, and it's yet to be discovered anywhere in our galaxy, anywhere in the universe. But what they're recognizing is, since this is showing up in an abundance level that's literally a factor of a million times lower than what our chemical models predict, that probably explains why we're not finding amino acids in any of these giant molecular clouds. Now, the reason why I'm raising this presents a profound challenge to all naturalistic models for the origin of life, because there's already consensus in the origin of life community that amino acids cannot form here on planet Earth. We know that because of what's called the oxygen ultraviolet paradox, is that if you have oxygen in the early Earth's environment, that will stop the formation of amino acids. If you don't have oxygen, there's nothing to stop ultraviolet radiation coming in from the sun, and that's just as catastrophic as the oxygen to stopping prebiotic chemistry. Moreover, we have isotope measurements that tell us that planet Earth never had prebiotic molecules. Now, all we see in planet Earth are the products of biological decay. We don't see the precursors of biological molecules, but for obvious reasons, because of the oxygen ultraviolet paradox. And this is really what launched the scientific discipline of astrobiology. However, astrobiology still ranks as the only scientific discipline that's data-free. We've yet to find any biological data anywhere in the universe. Man, you know, I'm being a little bit facetious there. I'm actually a supporter of astrobiology, just because I think a null result is just as important to establish as a positive result. But yeah, after 15 years of very generous funding, we've yet to find any evidence of prebiotics anywhere in the universe. Well, if they don't exist in the universe, they don't exist on planet Earth, you don't have a naturalistic model for the origin of life. All naturalistic models are predicated in the idea that you've got building blocks you put together. Well, we don't have the building blocks. Moreover, and I won't take the time to describe this, we don't have the time either. We now know that the origin of life happened on planet Earth in a geologic instant. I'll take a couple of questions, then I want to jump into the topic for today, which is Psalm 139 and some scientific tests we can make on the claims of Psalm 139 that God miraculously brings about the origin of human beings and our descent from two people, Adam and Eve. Yeah, go ahead, Al.
What do those molecular clouds look like? How do they find them?
Okay, what are these giant molecular clouds? Excuse me. My allergies are kicking up. Yeah, what are these molecular clouds? Well, they're dense, cool clouds of gas and dust. And they're cool enough that molecules can form. And as I mentioned, particularly in the giant molecular cloud that's at the center of our galaxy, they have found 123 carbonaceous molecules, things like hydrogen cyanide, for example, and glycolaldehyde have been found in these clouds. Another good place to look is the Orion Nebula. There's a couple of really dense, giant, cool molecular clouds there. So it's anywhere in our galaxy where you've got a dense concentration of cool gas and dust. And that's the best place to find complex molecules in our galaxy. And so this particular study, they picked the six biggest and densest giant molecular clouds to look for this molecule. And they were thinking, we got to find it in one. But they found it in none. Moreover, they found it that the upper limits they established were a million times lower than what they thought would be the detection level. Yes?
Well, what is the mass of these molecular clouds? The mass of the solar system, the mass of half our galaxy, how big are these things?
Well, they're massive enough that they're expected to produce between 1 and 5,000 stars. So they're not tiny. And they exist in the spiral arms of our galaxy and in the central core of our galaxy. That's where you find them. I mean, if you go to the NASA website and you look at these beautiful photo images of gaseous nebulae, you're basically looking at molecular clouds. Although the color you see is where it's hot enough to separate the molecules into atoms and strip the electrons off the atoms. And when you do that with hydrogen, you get a red color. When you do it with oxygen, you get kind of a blue-green color. And that explains why you get these gorgeous colors in these gaseous nebulae. You're basically looking at the hot spots within the cloud of gas and dust. The cool spots are where these molecules will form. But the cool spots will also collapse and heat up and form stars. So where you find these clouds is regions where stars are forming. So, for example, if you turn your pair of binoculars on the Orion Nebula and look at the central star of the sword that hangs down from the belt, you're looking at a giant molecular cloud. And actually, a pair of binoculars is strong enough. You've got, say, 8 by 40 or 10 by 50, you will be able to see several newborn stars. So, actually looking at a maternity ward. Yeah, go ahead.
We don't find prebiotic molecules either on the Earth or in space. And I was wondering how close we came to that on Earth. That is, there's some limit where you say that's prebiotic. Well, I'm not sure what that limit is and how close do we come to that limit.
Okay, well, that's a good question, because prebiotic molecules means different things in different contexts. I mean, for most lay people, a prebiotic molecule is either an amino acid, a 5 or 6 carbon sugar, or a nucleoside. And we're not finding that anywhere in the prebiotic Earth, and we're not finding that anywhere in our galaxy or the universe. We only see that stuff in living organisms. So,
how close do we come? As far as complexity.
How close we come? Probably the closest we come is glycoaldehyde, a 3-carbon sugar. We've yet to find 4, 5, or 6 carbon molecules. So, and you know, just to get to the sugars that you need to have the nucleotides bind together, you're going to need ribose. And so ribose is a 5-carbon sugar, so you can't make DNA, you can't make RNA unless you've got those. You also run into another problem. You cannot build proteins, DNA, or RNA unless the sugars are all right-handed and the amino acids are all left-handed. That's a whole different challenge to the origin of life problem, because nowhere on the Earth and nowhere in the universe do we see any process that produces what's called homochirality. The driving of all the amino acids to a left-handed configuration and the sugars to a right-handed configuration. So that's a separate challenge. This is actually what I call a simpler challenge, because there all we're talking about is how do you take a random mixture of left-handed and right-handed amino acids and separate all the left-handed ones. We can do it in a laboratory, but we don't see a process in nature that makes that work. The closest we come to that is what's called circularly polarized ultraviolet light that's being emanated by black holes and neutron stars. That will give you about a 1.17% at best favoritism of left versus right. But in order to make it work, it has to be 100% left and 0% right. And all they can get is a very tiny shift. Moreover, the neighborhood of a black hole or a neutron star is the worst place to try to drive prebiotic chemistry. The radiation there is guaranteed to break down the molecules. Yes?
In accordance with the idea that we were formed from a supernova and then spirited away from there to be over here, wouldn't the right place to look be in a supernova that we're just seeing now?
Well, the reason why we need supernova is that in order to have advanced life, we need a planet loaded with heavy elements, especially loaded with heavy radiometric elements, thorium and uranium, for example. And these are elements that are only formed in supernova. Every element heavier than iron can only come from a supernova. But it's more challenging than that. Different kinds of supernova make different suites of these elements heavier than iron. And the truth is, we need all of them for advanced life to be possible. So our sun needs to be born in the immediate vicinity of an exploding type 2B, type 2A, type 1A, type 1B supernova eruption. We also need to be in the immediate vicinity of what's called several giant asymptotic branch stars, because they produce elements that the supernova don't produce. And there's certain white dwarf binaries that will make the necessary fluorine that we need. And so that's why astronomers are persuaded the sun must have formed in a cluster of stars, a dense cluster of stars, that included a minimum of 3,000 stars, more likely 5,000 stars plus. Now that's significant because open clusters of what are called population 1 stars that are that size are extremely rare. I mean, I don't know of any current open clusters in our galaxy that have that many stars. But that's what's necessary in order to have Earth blessed with all the elements that it has. It's also crucial that at just the right time, we get a very powerful gravitational kick out of the cluster. Right. You don't want to hang into the cluster very long because we've got a radiation problem. You also got a gravitational problem. It's going to mess up your planets. And so you need a really, you want to be infected with all these heavy elements, get a good dose, and you want to be immediately kicked out. So if you actually get that series over there, Why God Made the Universe, a video series, and one of the episodes I actually take you through the history of the Earth and what had to happen to the Earth in order to get all the elements we need for advanced life. And you actually need a very aggressive kick out at just the right time, and that again is an extremely rare event. And that's just the beginning. You need several more events thereafter in order to wind up with a planet like Earth. So it tells us in the scriptures that the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. That's really, yeah, believe it, it's true. Yes?
And that explains why we find no solar twins, why we can't find any sub-star that's like ours that could support life. Is that correct?
That's correct, and that was actually part of my lecture at Imperial College in Britain when I was debating Lewis Wolpart. So I actually was making the point that not only must the universe be fine-tuned for life to be possible, but one of the evidences for a personal creator, because he was doubting the existence of a personal creator, is everything we see that's crucial for advanced life proves to be unique. I mean, there's literally, 50 billion trillion stars, and yet we find no twin of the sun that has the same characteristics that would permit the existence of advanced life in a planet orbiting it. We can't find a twin of Jupiter. We can't find a twin of Saturn or Uranus or Neptune or Mars or Earth or the moon for that matter. I mean, there's, 186 moons in our solar system, and ours sticks out like a sore thumb. Our moon is 50 times more massive compared to the mass of its planet than any other moon in our solar system. In fact, I was taking a number of members of my extended family. We had a wedding in our family last week, so I took them to the Griffith Observatory. And
Moon at the Griffith Observatory.
Well, it was before the honeymoon, so kind of. So we do have a strange family. So. But literally just how, when you go to the Griffith Observatory, you can just see how wonderfully designed all of the solar system planets are to make advanced life possible here on planet Earth. Literally every planet in our solar system plays a role except for Pluto, and maybe Pluto does too, we just don't know, but of course...
That's not a planet anymore.
It's not a planet anymore, so it doesn't qualify. We don't have to worry about that one anymore. It got demoted. Okay, well... For those of you that are relatively new to the class, every once in a while I like to launch off with a new scientific discovery that gives more scientific evidence for a Christian faith. But we also have a lesson we want to get into, and that's what we're doing now. What we've been doing these past few weeks is kind of looking at the challenges scientifically to the biblical doctrine that the entire human species is descended from two people, Adam and Eve, whom God specially created a few tens of thousands of years ago. And how do we respond to these scientific challenges? And kind of the text we've been looking at is Psalm 139. It's the most detailed text in the Bible that speaks about human origins. And it's quite clear in reading that text that God takes credit for the creation of humanity and takes credit for humanity's unique features of being the one species that's body, soul, and spirit. That's one of the texts that we go to that demonstrates that, when we are conceived is a time that we become a spiritual being. This is when God implants the spirit component of each one of us, and that's what separates us from the animals. But as we've been sharing, there has been a challenge coming from theistic evolutionists who claim that human genomics experiments prove that the ancestral population of human beings was 1,200 individuals. Now, if you read Francis Collins' book, it says 10,000, but the number's now dropped to 1,200. And actually, if you read books before Francis Collins, it was 100,000. If you read books that were 15 to 20 years old, it was in the millions. And so as we've been dialoguing with theistic evolutionists, we're encouraging them not to be too disturbed by the 1,200. The number is heading in the right direction. And let's just let the science run a little bit further and see what happens. But let me kind of review for you a little bit of the science we've discovered and then get right into the meat of what's happening with human genomics. And what has been taking place are what are called proxy experiments. You know, it's not always that ethical to do controlled laboratory-type experiments on human beings. For one reason, humans tend not to be that cooperative with those kinds of forced experiments. And so what we do is we use animals as a substitute for human beings to see what happens. And this is what was done on the Kerguelen Archipelago, a rather large set of islands in the South Indian Ocean. And the reason why this site has been picked as a laboratory location is that it's barren. I mean, there's no trees on the Kerguelen Archipelago. All you find are little grasses and mosses and things that are a few inches high off the ground. It's also a place where there's no mammals. And so this is kind of what it looks like. This is a research station. It's listed as having a population of zero, in spite of the fact that it's quite a bit bigger than the Falkland Islands. But it's no longer a population of zero. There are scientists that come and stay for a few months and leave. There are no permanent residents, but this is the one place where they actually have some buildings. But this is really what Kerguelen looks like. So it's not the most inviting place in the world. But if I can take you back to this particular map, what they did is they picked an island. That's called Haute Island right here. It's this little island right here. So it's quite well isolated from these other islands. And it's a place where there's very little animal life. And what they did in that island is that they introduced a pair of these creatures. These are mouflon sheep, and they purposely put a pair of mouflon sheep on Haute Island that were already seriously inbred. And so the idea is we're going to put a highly inbred couple on this island and see what happens to them as they reproduce. And so they just kind of left them alone on the island, but clearly the sheep couldn't leave the island. They were stuck there, and they had to eat what was available on that island. And by the way, the vegetation, this isn't on Kerguelen, the vegetation is actually sparser than what you see in this photo. So it was a tough place for these mouflon sheep, but they went back after more than a dozen generations of sheep had been produced. They already had a record of the DNA of this ingrown mouflon sheep couple, and the prediction was after 10 or 12 generations, they would see very little differentiation of the DNA. But were rather shocked that when they sampled the ancestors or the progeny 12 generations later, that they got an enormous amount of genetic diversity, far more than any of the genomics models predicted. And so what's going on here? Well, there really isn't an answer even to this day. This is kind of in the scientific literature as a paradox, that they were anticipating that there'd be very little DNA differentiation after a dozen generations. Instead, they got a whole lot. And likewise, they saw a similar thing with the Przewalski horse. As many of you know, the Przewalski horse is seriously endangered. This is a wild horse that runs around in Outer Mongolia. And it was a Penn State research team that compared the mitochondrial DNA of four different Przewalski horse lineages. And these were four highly ingrown lineages. And they concluded that the Przewalski horse and the domestic horse must have diverged much earlier than the previously calculated divergence time of 6,000 to 10,000 years. And bottom line, they got more genetic diversity than what the models predicted. And, you know, when we sat down, we've had a few conversations with the theistic evolutionists. Actually, they prefer to be called evolutionary creationists. And the distinction is this. A theistic evolutionist, many theistic evolutionists, take the position that God created the universe, designed the universe for life, and then basically let life, once he created it, just kind of evolve to produce what we see today. And most of them would deny the miracles in the Bible, both Old Testament and New Testament. The distinction is that evolutionary creationists take the same position on life. In fact, the ones we've talked to aren't even willing to say that God's responsible for the origin of life. They think a naturalistic process is responsible for the entire history of life, including the origin. However, they part company with traditional theistic evolutionists in that they fully endorse the miracles that Moses performs, for example, in Egypt and in Sinai. They accept all the miracles that we see at the hand of King David and Solomon, etc. And they also accept all the New Testament miracles. And really the distinction is any biblical miracle that can't be subjected to a scientific test, they're willing to accept. It's just those that can be subjected to scientific testing. And that's kind of where they draw the line. They say, you know, God doesn't really intervene in the affairs of nature. He only intervenes in the affairs of human beings once they're created. Of course, we've pointed out that that's a little bit inconsistent. If you've got God intervening in the affairs of human beings, wouldn't it make sense that he would be consistent and also intervene in the affairs of life in general? But I'll tell you what their rebuttal to that is. They say because human beings are a higher life form, God intervenes more frequently. And I would agree with that. But I don't think God takes a 3.8 billion year nap or 14 billion year long nap. But anyway, the Przewalski horse provides another challenge, as does studies done on orangutans. And there are basically two populations of wild orangutans today, one in Borneo and one in Sumatra. And there are about 7,000 wild orangutans in Sumatra and 45,000 in Borneo. And the expectation was that in Borneo we'd find far more genetic diversity than we find in the Sumatran orangutans. In fact, it's the opposite. It's the other way around. It's the smaller population that shows the greater genetic diversity. And here's a quote from the researcher who uncovered this, John Milton. He's not related to the John Milton. But he says this in his research paper, quote, "We don't fully understand the relationship between genetic diversity and population size." Now, that's a profound statement, because what's happening in the evolutionary creation crowd, the Biologos team, is they're saying that genetic diversity does give us an indication of the ancestral population size. But here you've got William Arnos, quoted by John Milton, saying exactly the opposite. Based on their research on orangutans, and I would add mouflon sheep and the Przewalski horse, population size is not a reliable indicator. Population size, ancestral population size, cannot be derived simply by measuring current genetic diversity. We got three separate instances that that's not what's going on. But let me make a suggestion here. What we're proposing in Reasons to Believe is that we go back to the Kerguelen Islands. We think this is an incredible laboratory site to do experiments on large mammals, small mammals and large mammals. Let's go there and take advantage of all these little islands that we see here. And because this is a place where you can actually do a controlled experiment. You know, it's thousands of miles away from any other biosystem, and we can do the same thing that was done on Pote Island, pick different islands, put different species of life. And the experiment we're proposing is this, because what we're suspicious, what's really going on here, is that the debate about DNA, is it all nature or is it all nurture? We believe the only way to explain these results is that it can't be all nature. If it's all nature, then the genomics models of BioLogos should be consistent with the field results. But they're radically inconsistent, which tells us nurture must have an impact on the DNA. And by the way, we already have some scientific evidence that that indeed is the case with human beings. In other words, the way you're nurtured during your developmental years can affect changes in the DNA and the gametes that get passed on to the next generation. We don't understand how that's happening, but we do have observational evidence that it is happening. Well, one way we can kind of get a better handle on that is to put different species of mammals on these islands. Birds won't work, they can fly away. But mammals that don't swim well, those are the ones you want to do these experiments on. And the water here is quite cold, so that kind of inhibits them from doing much swimming. But the experiment we're proposing is to put mammals with different development times and different levels of developmental complexity. I mean, we human beings have the longest development time and the greatest development complexity. And what I'm talking about is how we come out of the wombs of our mothers and how we wind up when we're 23, 24 years of age. I mean, it's a very long time of development and a very complex development. But we have different species. For example, chimpanzees take several years. I think it's like 7 or 8 years before they fully develop. So it'd be good to do some. This may be a little bit cold for chimpanzees, but rabbits, I mean, that's the whole point. Pick different mammals with different development times, different levels of complexity, and see if we can get a trend or a correlation between departure from the mathematical models relative to the longevity of the development time and the level of complexity of the development. If that were to be borne out, then I think we would have a case for saying that for human beings, nurture is going to have a huge impact on what happens to the DNA generation to generation that follows. It also has some theological implications. Because what did Moses tell us when he was speaking to the Jews in the desert there in the wilderness? He said the sins of the parents will be passed on to the children, to the third and fourth generation. The blessings of the parents will be passed on to the children, to the third and fourth generation. Often people quote the negative part, but Moses actually quoted both, that there are benefits to being born into a godly family. And there's consequences when it's the other way around. And it could be that God is warning us that the way you behave during your developmental years can have an impact on your offspring. And just the way your parents behave is going to influence the way you behave. So it kind of gives some kind of context. Now, I'm willing to concede that maybe I'm overinterpreting those passages. But my whole point is I think we got an opportunity to put it to the test. And maybe actually get a little more understanding of what these biblical texts are really saying one way the other. So I'm glad that God created a planet with an isolated large archipelago of islands like this. I was actually glad for another reason when I was in my early 20s. When I was in my early 20s, I took a course on radio telescope antenna design at the University of Toronto. And I was given the assignment of building or designing, to come up with a design for the world's most powerful pulsar telescope. And I realized pulsars, they emit their radio radiation at relatively low wavelengths, which means you're going to have a problem with radio interference. You want to go to a place where there's very little radio interference. And we said, of all the places on the planet, this has got the least radio interference. And also, we needed a place where we could build a giant array of radio telescopes, which meant we needed a place where there's very little temperature change. And the Kerguelen Islands has a temperature variation of less than 5 degrees day and night, summer and winter. That's because of where it's surrounded by this ocean. And as you can see, it has this nice flat place called Peninsula Corbet right here. And this is about 70 miles down and 50 miles wide. It's big enough to put a giant radio telescope array. And this is the place where they have that little research village, which means you've already got a developed port. So that was actually part of my radio telescope design. Well, let's build it there. The one negative part about that is that how do you get radio astronomers to live there? But it's still the most pristine place in the world because of its tremendous isolation, more than 3,500 miles from any human habitation.
How do they get there?
Yeah, by boat. It's a long boat ride. There's no airport. You basically take a boat to get there. All your supplies have got to be brought in because you can't grow anything there that's fit to eat. So, those are the downsides. Pardon me?
What's the temperature?
The median temperature is about 50 degrees. So it varies between about 47 and 51. That's kind of the temperature range. And you do get a little bit of wind, but not enough wind to make it a problem.
Well, if it was 10 degrees higher, I'd go there.
Uh-huh.
Build an airstrip.
Can you put any ski resorts on the glacier?
Well, people have cross-country skied on that glacier.
Well, there you go.
But it's a rather challenging hike to get there, as you can see. So.
Is this as far south as the tip of South America?
Okay. You're basically at 50 degrees. This is 49.30 south right here. That's the 49th parallel, 49.30. So it's quite a bit south. But it's not so far south that it's frozen all the time. And it gets very little rainfall. That's the other big advantage of this place, not much rain. At least that would be the case for radio astronomy. For the sheep, it might be tough. But given that it's so cool there, the fact that it only gets 10 to 15 inches of rain doesn't mean you can get grasses growing there that they can eat. So, yes, in the back.
How does the nature nurture DNA and correlate with homosexuality?
Well, that is an issue that we're studying. That's kind of one reason why we're proposing doing this kind of field research. And the whole point is that we want to solve the problem of human origins from a scientific perspective. You need to have theoretical models, mathematical models, that fit very neatly with your experimental field results. And that's kind of the missing thing in the debate today. That's why we're calling for these kinds of experiments. And, from our perspective at Reasons to Believe, the challenge of theistic evolution, evolutionary creationism, is they believe the human genomics data is so compelling that we need to change the creeds of the church and abandon the traditional interpretation, for example, of Romans 5, 6, 7, and 8. Well, the problem with that is that's the heart of the gospel. There's a reason why that shows up in all the creeds. That really explains the means by which we can come into a salvific relationship with the creator of the universe. So it's not, and by the way, evolutionary creationists admit that's the biggest challenge to their model. The fact that it requires, from their perspective, such a radical reinterpretation of Paul's writings in Romans. But our whole point is that step is certainly premature when your scientific models are failing to match the field results. There's nothing there that would compel any major reinterpretation of the Bible, in our opinion. And our whole point is, this is testable. Let's put it to the test and see what happens. Yes?
Hugh, in one aspect, we have observational where we know that obviously nurture does change, at least biologically changes, that a young baby that is not handled, that's not nurtured, not cared for, that it totally alters brain development, and if that doesn't change by the time you're fully grown, the brain will never mature. We have children that have been abused.
Right.
We've seen that, but obviously that they couldn't figure out why they weren't able to educate to a certain level, and they just froze. And so we know that, from homosexual studies, we know also homosexual activity will change the chemistry and the makeup of the brain. It's not the other way around. So, you know, homosexual the brain, is that activity will change the brain. That's been proven. So the question I would be was, is that nurture, though, going to be able to act, will that actually change the DNA of the offspring of those people is the question.
Okay.
We don't know, right?
Right now, we have no evidence that homosexual behavior will alter the gametes that are passed on to the next generation. And one of the great difficulties is that homosexuals don't produce children. So for that very reason, I think it's very challenging to claim that there's a homosexual gene, because by the very nature of homosexuality, there isn't reproduction. So, but we do know that there are other forms of behavior that will change the DNA in the gametes. And so the way you live will impact how your children will be designed in terms of their DNA. What we don't know is to what degree and exactly where. And so there's a lot of speculation that maybe the way people behave could mean that their offspring would have a homosexual lifestyle, but there's no evidence for that right now. There is evidence that alcoholism and drug abuse does have a genetic impact on the next generation. But so far, we have no evidence of that with respect to homosexuality. What Dave pointed out is right. We do have evidence that homosexual behavior changes the chemistry of the brain. And there's research papers that claim that this was genetic. The problem was all the research was done on practicing adult homosexuals. I mean, to really prove their point, they'd have to do it on young boys and young girls and show that you had the same brain chemistry operating there, and that's not there. You'll only see it in adults, and moreover, only in adults that are practicing their homosexual lifestyle. So, and one experiment that's been suggested, but I don't think it's ever been performed, is to take people that identify themselves as homosexual that are celibate and compare them with homosexuals that are aggressive in practicing their homosexual lifestyle. As far as I know, there hasn't been experiments looking at those two subsets. I got my suspicions as to what kind of results that would be produced. As far as I know, those experiments have not been run. And again, the difficulty with human subjects is controlling them. And you know, one thing that my son's into neuropsychology and cognitive psychology, and he says the biggest challenge is trying to figure out what the humans really are doing. They'll tell you one thing and they're doing something completely different. We tend to lie to our researchers, and that's the wonderful thing about working with sheep. They can't lie to you, but humans can. And so anyway, there was a hand over here, yeah.
So if you put these sheep out there and they turn out to be homosexual, say 10%, like most of the population, I think. And so how are you gonna prove whether it's nurture or nature with sheep or animals? We know humans have them too, but it seems to be.
Well, it's quite possible, Al, that with homosexuality, it's all nurture and not nature. I mean, we don't have any evidence that there's a genetic link there. We do have some evidence for other forms of behavior, but not yet for homosexuality. The experiments could be done. And incidentally, be careful about these reports that talk about widespread homosexuality amongst wild animals. What you notice is you see it when you take away the mating options, the normal mating options. So, for example, and, you know, farmers will tell you this. If you've got a bunch of cows out there in the field and it's mating season and there's no bulls around, you're going to see them humping one another. And that's the farmer's signal, bring the bull. So, That doesn't mean those cows are homosexual. It just means that the farmer has artificially separated the males and the females. And so, and likewise, that can happen. People have noticed that you can get a donkey mating with a horse. You can do it if you take away all the other donkeys. And all you do is you provide the only option of a horse. So, and those of us who have had pets realize that happens too. We had a rabbit that was trying to have intercourse with a guinea pig. But they don't do that in the wild. There's always rabbits around. But when you take away the option, so you have to be very careful when you're drawing conclusions. Because I've read lots of studies where they say, we see this high level of homosexual activity in the wild, but when you actually read the paper, you discover it's a contrived experiment. It's not something that would actually happen in the real world.
So they never found the gene that was saying that will cause homosexuality?
Yeah. They've never found a gene in humans. They've never found a gene in animals. But as one researcher, in fact, a number of researchers have pointed out, for obvious reasons, homosexuality doesn't reproduce after its own kind. And therefore, if there was a gene, it would quickly be rid out of the gene pool. It's not going to survive. And that's just basic as natural selection. If you've got a gene that's unsuccessful in terms of reproduction, it will be weeded out. So if there was a homosexual gene, it would have disappeared long ago.
Yeah, so what's the solution?
Well,
is it human nature?
Well, let me suggest this. Then we've got to close. The Bible makes the point that we are to restrain homosexual activity. You need to understand, because Jesus was struck with that, where they said, we caught this woman in adultery, should we stone her as the law requires? And Jesus put it back on the scribes and the Pharisees, saying, you yourselves don't go to that extent. And what he was pointing out is that Moses set limits to what the legal system could do. Our legal system does the same thing. We have maximum penalties for every offense against society. But the jury and the judge does not have to exercise the maximum penalty, but they're told they can go up to that penalty. So depending on the individual and the degree to which that individual is committed to that kind of behavior, you can go up to that maximum level. But if you actually read what was going on in Moses' generation, the other nations, when they caught a murderer, would kill the murderer and the entire murderer's family. And Moses said, the maximum penalty, to take the life of the murderer. You do not touch his family, only the murderer. And it's a maximum penalty. David, for example, was forgiven his sin of murder. He was repentant. And so where you see contrition and repentance, the courts are allowed to show mercy, just like our courts today are allowed to show mercy. On the other hand, what you see in the Old Testament is, do not be so merciful that you don't restrain the behavior. And just to close up, I think that's the problem we're seeing with homosexuality today, because I can remember as a graduate student in Toronto, they had serious laws restraining homosexual behavior, and they estimated there were a maximum of 60,000 homosexuals and lesbians in a population of 4 million. Well, that was 1970. Today, that population is about 600,000. So it's gone from 60 to 600,000 in just 42 years. What has happened in Canada, it began with Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, is that they legalized it. So you could practice any form of homosexuality. You can get married. You can adopt children. There's basically zero restraints on homosexuality. And what the Bible warns us is that when you take those restraints away, it will run out of control. And when it runs out of control, it becomes a serious threat to society. Obviously, if everybody becomes homosexual, what's that going to do to the future of the United States and Canada? They'll disappear from the face of the earth.
That goes back to
Al. Al.
Yeah, we got to close.
No more questions.
Okay.
No more questions.
All right. Yeah, we are out of time. And by the way, I got to run to the airport, so I'm going to have to close up and take off. So if you want questions, catch me next week. And when I come back next week, I'm going to be coming back from a late night flight. So I may be a little, well, anyway, I'll do my best. Father in heaven, we do thank you that we live in such a wonderful day and age when we can put our belief systems to such a rigorous and thorough test. And Lord, thank you that you were the first to say it, that we're to put everything to the test and hold fast to that which is good. But Father, I pray you would make us skeptics and not cynics, that when we see that something indeed has passed the test and is good, that we'd be willing to embrace it, to adopt it and make it part of our life. So Father, give us the necessary humility and submission to receive the truth that you've given us and to apply it to our own lives. In Jesus' name, amen.
Remember the brochures.